Dr. Benner, and this is the Shelbourne East Center podcast. We're starting episode 37 tonight, and we have another good topic to discuss tonight as it relates to range of motion and total knee arthroplasty. Last week, we talked about rates of total knee arthroplasty depending on where the arthritis was located and differential progression to disease percentages between the medial, lateral, and patellofemoral compartments. And it was an interesting discussion that Scott and I had about another previous study that we had done. So check out last week's episode. Also, if you'd like to check out our previous content, we're on pretty much every podcast platform. We've got all of our content up there on our podcast pages, and you can check out any of that stuff. We'd also like to hear from you if you'd like to leave us a 5-star review or follow the podcast so you don't miss any of our upcoming content. We've got some good guests lined up for the next few weeks, and we think we're going to continue to give you some good content about knee problems.
Tonight's episode, we're going to be focusing on the factors that affect post-op flexion, in particular, how preoperative flexion can affect post-operative flexion. And this is going to be a good topic both for you and I to discuss, as it's another one that really covers both the rehab aspect of things as well as the surgical aspect of things, and really looking to see what factors can influence that post-operative flexion and ultimately outcomes post-operative after total knee replacement. So we'll jump right in, and Dr. Benner, couple things that we want to hit here. We did a study looking at the effects of pre-op flexion on post-operative flexion with total knees. But before we get into that, what's the background on this topic? And what have you seen at meetings? What have you looked at in the past? And what have you seen as been major players when it comes to what influences post-op flexion?
Well, there's been some previous research done about this by colleagues here in the Indianapolis area. For those that don't know, we do have our practice in Indianapolis, and just not too far down the road in Mooresville, Indiana, is the Center for Joint Replacement, where Dr. Merrill Ritter set up his group. And one of his big contributions to the literature was just a discussion about how preoperative range of motion relates to postoperative range of motion. And I think that's something that pretty much everybody around the world understands and realizes, that pre-op motion does in some way dictate post-op motion. And because of that, and subsequently to that, that post-op motion does have a lot of impact on outcome. And we have Dr. Ritter and his group to thank for some of that knowledge. It seems pretty intuitive now, but at the time, I don't know if that was necessarily the case during earlier prosthesis development phases, where people were unsure how much range of motion the replaced knee would tolerate. I think to be able to look at factors and figure out why people ended up with bad range of motion at sometimes, and that led to a bad outcome, and just understanding the contribution of pre-op motion was an important one. And from our perspective now, trying to fit that together with what we do preoperatively, trying to keep people out of surgery in particular, but also if they do have surgery, how do we maximize their outcome? It's something that everybody around the world is continuing to chase with knee arthroplasty, and a topic that I still think is germane to all of our practices.
Now, the concept of pre-op motion influencing post-op motion, and you talked about Merrill Ritter's work on that. Have you seen or are you aware of any situations where that may not be the case, and you know that going into surgery, whereas, you know, for example, a patient has X degrees of motion with certain varus valgus deformities, and you think that this is not going to necessarily be as good or what? Or are there any scenarios that really may not be the case that you know of ahead of time?
Well, part of that was while we did this study, I wondered if we applied those same kinds of parameters to individual groups of preoperative range of motion, whether that would still play its way out. I agree with Dr. Ritter's findings that pre-op motion dictates post-op motion, but I wondered with modern implants and modern techniques done, you know, a couple decades after he did a lot of that initial work on this topic, whether or not that would still be the case. And my thought was, especially with all the physical therapy and rehabilitation we do and modern implants, modern techniques, whether or not we might find that people who have a lower amount of range of motion don't necessarily end up with low range of motion. Just see what the relationship was, what the relationship was in 2024.
Now, before we get into the study, you had mentioned modern techniques and modern implants. Can you touch on that a little bit further and discuss what in particular may influence that when it comes to the actual implant itself, when it comes to postoperative flexion or postoperative range of motion in general?
Yeah, I think, the design folks at with all the different companies have become particularly cognizant of bone preservation. That's one thing that's been a little bit different. I know for the implant that I use, I think that's a much more bone preserving implant than it used to be or the previous iterations were. I think they've become much more in tune with sizing. You know, for example, the system that I use now has 2 millimeter increments on the femoral side and a lot of options on the tibial side, as well as narrow versions. Before that, there was gender specific total knees that were, now I think are just more like a narrow variant of the standard implant. And before that, they were like 4 millimeters between each femoral component size. We often had to make some compromises between, between sizes. Do I make it a couple millimeters too large or a couple millimeters too small? And that's a compromise that we don't have to make anymore. I also think there's been some work on, the curve posterior, the J curve posteriorly of the posterior condyles, wrapping that a little bit more tightly around the back to really allow the femoral component to kind of flex around the posterior portion of the tibial component more in deep flexion. That I think is an innovation as well. You know, there's a lot of people that have been discussing mechanical versus kinematic alignment and wondering whether that has an impact on range of motion and patients' ability to get pain relief, which then leads to more range of motion. There's a question about robotics as well. Do we get better with gap balancing and alignment with robotic technology, and does that lead to an improvement in range of motion as well? So those are kind of some of the implant and technique variations that I think have happened in the last several years that we wonder whether or not that'll have an impact on outcomes and for me, range of motion specifically.
So this study, along with a lot of our other studies, and whether we're talking about knee replacements, osteoarthritic knees, patellofemoral realignments, or ACL reconstructions, we really harp on range of motion. And as it pertains to the total knee population, can you talk about the importance of that and why we focus on that both preoperatively and postoperatively?
I feel like most of the studies we're talking about have dealt with range of motion on this podcast. And really, we talk about this every day at the office, as you know. And I think it all goes back to Dr. Shelbourne's research over the course of the last 4 decades that spawned from ACL literature and now has been taken on to the arthritic knee patients and total knee replacement. Just in the ACL reconstruction patients, even small degrees of stiffness have led to higher degrees of osteoarthritis, worse outcomes, functional outcomes as well. And with that, now we've taken that forward to, does that apply to arthritic knee conditions as well? Can we improve range of motion can we improve stiffness once it's already there and make a difference in arthritic knee care? And I think we've shown, in my opinion, in our experience, pretty convincingly that is the case. And then the next piece of it, as it relates to post-op total knee outcomes, is can we identify factors that improve range of motion and can that help us to maximize outcomes in the post-operative phase following knee arthroplasty as well? So, this all has its basis in Dr. Shelbourne's research in our office over the last 4 decades that have really put the puzzle pieces together one at a time to come up with kind of a comprehensive plan for knee problems. And with that comes a real focus on range of motion. So I'm sure some of our listeners are probably tired of hearing it when we talk about it, but we only do so because we think it's just such an important key factor in really all types of knee problems. And Scott, that seems like a good jumping off point for this study. Tell us a little bit about the name of this study, who's on it, and kind of what we looked at here.
Sure. So the title of the study was The Effects of Preoperative Flexion on Postoperative Flexion and Subjective Outcomes After Total Knee Arthroplasty. And the authors on this were Sarah Eaton, former physical therapist at our office, myself, yourself, as well as Elena Gillenwater, current physical therapist at the office. And again, we really took the rationales that we discussed about in the first 10 minutes or so of this episode, and we wanted to take those principles and really apply them to our own patients and see what factors can play into leading to higher postoperative flexion and then go one step further, what the subjective outcomes is going to look like based on the post-op flexion. So what we did was took patients of yours, so a single orthopedic surgeon clinic here, and enrolled them into a study. And we ended up getting from 2012 to 2021, 588 patients that had a unilateral and primary knee replacement, which we feel was an important designation for this study, as we wanted to exclude the bilaterals, the staged procedures, as well as the revisions. And we took those patients and we divided them in three groups. And the groupings were low, average, and high range of motion. And we designated that as less than 120 degrees for the low group, 120 to 134 degrees for the average group, and greater than 135 degrees for the high group. And then from an outcome standpoint, we wanted to look at the change in flexion for each of those three groups. We wanted to see what percentage of the patients in each of those three groups stayed the same with in regards to range of motion, improved a grouping, or went down by a grouping that was pre-designated. And then the last thing, we wanted to look at the one-year KOOS scores based on those groupings, both preoperatively and postoperatively.
All right, Scott. So once we got that population together in this study, what kind of run through the results of this study for our listeners?
Sure. So the biggest thing, or the first thing I should say, we wanted to look at was what type of mean change in flexion that these patients in each of these three groups were able to attain. And for the low group, preoperatively, these were the patients that were starting off less than 120 degrees of flexion. Their average range of motion preoperatively was 106 degrees, and they were able to improve that to 120 degrees on average. The average group started off between 120 and 134, averaged out to be 126 degrees, and they were able to improve to 130 degrees postoperatively. And then lastly, the high group, which was those that started off above 135 degrees, and they were on average starting off at 140 degrees and stayed pretty similar, although dropped a degree on average to 139 degrees. Now, the second thing we wanted to look at was to see what percentage of patients in each grouping got better, stayed the same, or got worse. And the way we defined that was going down to a lower grouping, staying at the same grouping, or going up to a higher grouping on the predetermined low, average, and high groups that we designated earlier. So for the low group, 38% of patients stayed in the low group, which means they were started off less than 120 degrees, and then after surgery, they stayed in the less than 120 degree grouping, which means that 62% of patients were able to go up and get better from pre-op to post-op. So 62% of patients that started off lower than 120 degrees were able to get to 120 degrees or better after surgery. For the average grouping, patients that started off between 120 and 134 degrees, only 7% of those patients got worse, and which means 93% of patients were able to stay the same or get better. And then in particular with this group, since we do have a better group for the average, 30% were able to go from the average grouping to the high. So starting off between 120 and 134 degrees, 30% of these patients were able to jump up to the high grouping designated at greater than or equal to 135 degrees. And then lastly, with the high group, those that start off 140 degrees on average, 23% of these patients actually got worse, means they went from the high group to either the low or the average group. But the majority, the 77% of these patients, were able to stay in that high group. So they started off at 135 degrees preoperatively, and then 77% of them were able to stay in that greater than 135 degrees postoperatively after surgery. Now, the last thing we wanted to look at here was to take those groups and whether for each group, whether you got better, same, or worse after surgery. We wanted to compare your one-year KOOS score to see if getting better, worse, or staying the same related to any type of improvement in KOOS score after surgery. And across the board, the patients that were better, meaning they jumped up a category, whether it was low to average or high or average to high, those patients were doing better on the KOOS score postoperatively. However, it was not statistically significantly different after surgery. For example, the high group, those that got worse scored an 83 on the postoperative KOOS score compared to those that stayed in the same group scored an 87. So 83 compared to 87 was not statistically significantly different. However, across the board, all of the low, the average, and the high, those that were able to get better over time were able to score better on the KOOS scores.
And some interesting trend lines that we find in this data when we look at the first analysis you did, just pre-op to post-op range of motion for the low, average, and high group. If you look at the low group, they went from 106 pre-op to 120 post-op as their mean flexion. So they made a mean 14-degree improvement. For the average group, they went from 126 pre-op to 130 post-op. So they got a smaller amount of improvement. And for the large group, pre-op was 140, post-op 139, so essentially the same. And I think that's an interesting thing that we do notice clinically, that people who have lower degrees of range of motion are more likely to make a more significant improvement in their knee flexion than people who have average flexion, and that people who have a high degree of flexion may stay the same or even slightly go down just slightly. And you see that also when we look at the frequency distribution as well, that the majority of the patients in the low group, 62% of them end up in the average or the high group post-surgery. The average group kind of stays average with a slight tilt towards the high group, and then the high group stays high with a few dropping down. Another thing that's important to highlight is that when these patients go from one group to the next, that could be as little as a 1 degree difference. So that there are some inherent limitations in making big trends with these numbers. For example, if a patient had 121 degrees pre-surgery and then had 119 degrees post-surgery, that moves them from the average group to the low group. But in reality, I think we all would agree that that's a 2 degree difference. It's not that much of a significant difference. So I think the trend line is the important thing. And then last but not least, with the COOS, pretty much in every group, the groups that stayed the same or got better had an increase in their functional outcome scores. And I think with that, that's something we would all agree with, that if you get the same range of motion back or you improve your range of motion, you're probably more likely to have functional outcome benefits compared to those that did not. And I think that's particularly important clinically when people think about, well, how much range of motion do you need? And for me, the answer is always going to be as much as you can get. I've always said this, and I will continue to say it for the rest of my career. I've never had somebody come in and say, my knee is doing fantastic, I just wish it didn't bend so far. That nobody ever says that ever. Everybody always wants the best flexion that they have. It's more capacity for function. It's more ability to kind of put their knees in different positions when they're sitting in a low chair, for example, or getting down on the floor, for example, that they just can't do if they don't have enough knee flexion to be able to do it. So another interesting group of trend lines from this data.
Yeah, on that note, you talked about people never having a scenario where somebody had too much range of motion. The last analysis that we did on this study was just looking at post-op COOS based on post-op range of motion, and we grouped them post-operatively in a similar fashion with the low, average, and high, and the same exact range of motion for each group in terms of the grouping. And we wanted to look statistically at that post-operative COOS and to see if that differed based on the grouping. And we were able to show that there was a statistically significant difference based on the group, with the low group, so those that finished postoperatively 1 year after surgery, less than 120 degrees of flexion on average, were scoring 81 on the COOS, compared to the groups of average and high, both at 86. And again, statistically, the 81 versus both groups in the 86 was statistically significantly lower. So that just shows from a statistical standpoint, proving your point of patients are generally more happy with higher flexion levels. So, Dr. Benner, based on all of these results and how some pre-op flexion numbers seem to have an impact on post-op flexion, a couple of questions. What's your clinical relevance take-home from this study? And then second question would be, do the results of this study change your practice in terms of surgical decision-making before surgery?
Well, I'll answer the second one first. I think where this changes my surgical decision making is if somebody doesn't have good range of motion, or we haven't at least made an attempt to get people better range of motion, then we need to do that after surgery, because we know that people who have better motion pre-op do get a bigger improvement post-op than if they had worse motion, and that they have better outcomes. So it's just more fuel to the fire that if we don't need to operate on somebody, we shouldn't until we maximize maximize their functional abilities. Now, this study didn't specifically note that, so I don't think we can make that claim based on this specific study. However, I think in the context of our previous studies and our previous podcast, you can go back and listen to as well our series on non-surgical treatment of OA of the knee, that it all does kind of fit together, that it's really important for us to maximize range of motion pre-op in order to be able to maximize motion post-op and get the best outcome for our patients. And as far as the clinical relevance goes, I think not only can we counsel our patients that pre-op motion dictates post-op motion, but we can give them some sort of an idea of how much improvement they can make. I think the results of this study show us that if you don't have very good range of motion, you can get a significant improvement post-surgery versus if you already have good range of motion, or if we get you good range of motion pre-surgery, then we can know that that's going to predict that they'll have good motion after surgery. I think it's also interesting to review this kind of stuff and also have these discussions with patients that if a patient comes in with 150 degrees of flexion or 145 degrees of flexion, then I will sometimes tell them, you know what, you have such high flexion that a prosthetic knee may not even accommodate that. And that you may not be able, you may even lose a little bit of flexion, but that your flexion is so high anyway that I don't think you'll notice any kind of a functional deficit associated with it.
Yeah, I would agree with those clinical relevance points there. Lastly, before we wrap up, any general or global take-home points based on the results of this study?
Yeah, I think it just plays back into our general philosophy about range of motion and arthritic knees, that if pre-op motion dictates post-op motion, and if post-op motion dictates outcome, then my opinion, that means that pre-op motion dictates outcome. And the better we can get our pre-op motion, the better our outcome is. So that's an important point on pre-operative physical therapy, pre-operative optimization of the patient's functional gains on the front end leads to better outcomes later. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that a lot of times, this is a big frustration of mine and I hope people can learn from, a lot of times people use this kind of data and these relationships in order to almost make an excuse post-surgery for why their patients didn't get their range of motion back. I don't know how many times that I've heard people discuss this, and the way they discuss it is after the surgery's already been done, after the patient's already had kind of a poor outcome and stiffness, then they go back. Then I've heard surgeons say, well, you remember back before surgery, you had bad motion to begin with, so that probably explains why you have bad motion now. And of course, that's true. However, I wish that that surgeons would kind of shift gears from that kind of thinking and think, since we have that information and we know that that relationship exists, what can we do pre-surgery, to maximize range of motion and realize the big improvements that could potentially give our patients post-operatively, rather than wait until after they've already had a bad outcome and use this information to explain why it happened. Let's use this information on the front end to keep it happening from the beginning.
All good points. I appreciate you going over this study and the clinical relevance behind the results. So if you want to get a hold of us, you can reach out to us via our social media platforms. You can reach out on Twitter and Instagram at the SKC Podcast. You can visit our YouTube and Facebook SKC Podcast pages or email us at the SKC Podcast at gmail.com. And we will see you guys next week.